Good morning, Colorado. You're listening to the Daily Sun Up with a Colorado Sun. It's Wednesday, May 17th. Today, Governor Jared Polis and four state lawmakers joined Colorado Sun political editor Jesse Paul last week for an event recapping the 2023 legislative session. The following is an excerpt from Jesse's conversation with Polis, who just began his second four-year term leading the state. You can find a full recording of the event at coloradosun.com. Before we start, a quick message. Citywide Banks, a division of HTLF Bank, is a Colorado-focused community bank celebrating 60 years of helping companies grow and families thrive. They keep decision-making to a local level, and bankers are focused on providing impactful financial solutions for your business. Visit citywidebanks.com to learn more. Citywide Banks is a member FDIC and an equal housing lender. Now, let's go back in time with some Colorado history. From 1957 through 1973, the Atomic Energy Commission conducted 27 nuclear detonations and planned many more in Project Plowshare, which was intended to transform weapons into tools of progress through peaceful nuclear explosions. Most of the tests experimented with the human impact of such activity, while others had more specific goals. Two bombings under western Colorado intended to promote oil development by fracturing shale. The project enjoyed influential support from Congressman Wayne Aspinall, whose district encompassed much of western Colorado, while other politicos, including Governor John Love, expressed hesitancy about the scheme. The first detonation in Colorado took place in Garfield County in 1969, near lucrative shale deposits at Parachute. A bomb much smaller than those used against Japan during World War II fractured an area 400 feet in diameter, but the oil and natural gas extracted proved too contaminated by radiation to use. The second Colorado explosion, and the last of Project Plowshare, went off in Rio Blanco County on this date in 1973. Three bombs, each twice as powerful as the one dropped on Hiroshima in 1945, went off at the same time, but they also proved unsuccessful in releasing clean liquid fuel. Coloradans amended their constitution in 1974 to ban nuclear detonations in the state without voter approval. National support for Project Plowshare fizzled in the face of environmental fears. In its place, the oil industry turned to hydraulic fracturing, or fracking, in the early 21st century, which often proved just as controversial. Before we continue, the Colorado Sun's 2023 Reader Survey is open. Fill out the survey and let us know your thoughts. Whether you're a Colorado Sun member, newsletter subscriber, or reader, we want to hear from you. Visit cosun.com/2023readersurvey today. Next, our feature story.
And I know during your State of the State speech, you kind of talked about housing a ton. It was kind of declared the session of housing. It wasn't something that you mentioned in your intro and kind of the bills that you highlighted. And obviously, the thing that sucked up a lot of oxygen at the Capitol this year was the land use bill that you kind of heralded as the long-term way to solve the affordable housing crisis in Colorado. Measure was pared back almost immediately when it was heard in the legislature, ultimately failed Monday night in Senate, kind of in an 11th hour breakdown of negotiations or inability to move forward. I wonder what you chalk that up to. You know, this was a really ambitious piece of legislation and something that you talked about so much, I feel like, from the start of the session. What happened? Was there not enough, you know, stakeholding on the front end? Why did this not make it through?
Well, first of all, I think you said it was weakened in the process. Just to be clear, it was also strengthened in the process. The House put a lot more back in it. So yes, it was initially weakened and then it was strengthened, as often happens, you know, legislative process. This is a big problem our state faces. And I think what I'm trying to do as governor is help this happen a few years before it would happen on its own. Washington State, average home price in Seattle, $850,000. Republicans and Democrats, were able to pass similar policies allowing duplexes and quadplexes and single family zoned across the state. But it took getting to $850,000. Montana passed a similar bill this legislative session as well. They've experienced a huge run up in housing prices. We're at about $600,000 in the average home price in the Denver metro. So I guess the question is, does it have to get worse before we demand action? And what does worse mean? It means less affordable. Or is there a course that we can take now? And I obviously, like as somebody who likes to look around the corner, likes to say, hey, this is becoming a detriment to our economy. It's a typical example of government overreach, of an artificial scarcity that's created just by government regulations almost entirely. Left to its own in a free market, the housing market, you know, keeps up with the demand, and you look at the replacement cost of a house and some margin for somebody, and you know, we probably have homes that were, you know, 200 or 300,000 in the Denver metro area. We don't. The average is 600,000. Why? Because of artificial scarcity created by a systemic issue we have in our state that prevents the free market from operating. So we took solutions from, you know, Common Sense Institute, Cato Institute, others that Republicans and Democrats had implemented in other states. And I don't think it's so much a question of if Colorado will do it. I think they will. But the question is, they could do it in 8 years if we don't push this now and prevent a lot of pain from happening from a lot of people who can't afford to live here if we don't solve this sooner rather than later.
I guess just to drill down, though, what happened? I mean, there was so much pressure from your office on the lawmakers who were on these committees, this was felt different. You know, there were so many bills.
I don't think it was. I think it was pressure from the people of our state. I mean, I ran on a platform of housing, and I won by almost 20 points, right? 19.6 points, but who's counting? Many legislators ran on this platform, and they sponsored these bills. They fought for them. I guess there were others that, you know, didn't run on or didn't care about housing or, you know, were beholden to, you know, special interests and government regulations on the local side that they wanted to just regulate the state out of existence. And I get that. But I think we've got to loosen the regulations and allow homes to be built to keep up with the market demand. I mean, it's just common sense. And, you know, it just gets worse until it gets better, Jesse. There's no other solution than removing the artificial constraints on supply. And that's why that's the path that a number of other states have taken. And I hope my goal, as I articulated in the State of the State, is I really care a lot about Colorado. I don't want us to become like California. There are cities in California with $1 million home prices. We have an opportunity to avoid that fate here, but we need to be bold, and we need to do that. And I was proud to see a relatively strong bill pass the House by a strong margin. Didn't have everything in it that was needed on the middle housing front, but certainly around accessory dwelling units and transit, it absolutely would have moved the bar in housing. A very strong bill, even stronger, came out of the Senate Housing Committee that included middle housing. So, you know, it's just a question of how we get there. And, you know, I can be governor of a state with $1 million homes as the average. It saddens me that you know, we're not a state where people can afford to live, but I'm hoping that we can avoid that and have the foresight to take a better path, because we've seen this play out in a number of states.
And I kind of think you hinted that this will come back. I wonder if you can talk about what form. A lot of our reader questions tonight are kind of asking, you know, will zoning mandates be in there? Will, you know, parking requirements? Will you try again next year? And how will you change?
Well, I mean, everything is a cost thing, right? So what does a parking requirement mean? It usually adds $20,000 to $40,000 to a home. And by the way, I'm all for parking. If you buy a place and you want parking, by all means buy parking, but we should let the market determine that rather than central planners and politicians, right? So you shouldn't subvert the market by saying, oh, as a politician, I know better, and I think you should have two parking places because you have X square feet. Let supply and demand work that out. So, I mean, again, all these things add cost to housing, and the more that more regulations we can get rid of, the lower the cost of the housing will be, because it'll meet the market demand.
And how about bringing this policy or some version of it next year? Do you think that'll happen?
Well, I think the problem gets worse. I think that there'll be even more desire to tackle housing, the less affordable it is. As I said, I think, you know, as governor, I try to lead. I could certainly, you know, if you had a governor sat back and done nothing, we're probably 6 years away from solving this. You know, hopefully by leaning into it, we do it in a year or two and build to remove the burdensome regulations that are causing this crisis and artificially raising home prices beyond what most people can afford.
Okay. And not to drill down too much on it, but just to be fair, if I said that it's coming back next year, would that be a fair statement or in some?
Well, I think, look, I don't think you've ever seen this diverse and important a coalition wanting change. And what do I mean by that? Businesses, chamber, unions, same side, arm in arm. Environmentalists, housing advocates, arm in arm. So this is, and again, what's driving it all is just the mandate, as somebody who ran for office that I have, to do something about the high cost of housing. So I think politicians feel a need to solve it. I think the business community, workers need a place to live. Businesses need a place for workers to be able to live, to be able to thrive. People are absolutely crying out for solutions, and it'll fall on the state legislature to address this.
And one last question on this bill before we do move on. I wonder, when you started this process, if you believe that there was enough support in the legislature to move it through, or if you felt like it would build support as things kind of went on, as more hearings happened.
Well, I think everybody who took this on, Stephen Woodrow, Amaran Judah, others, knew that it's always a big deal to challenge the status quo. We've been doing things the same way in our state since 1974 for land use. And it worked for a while, but it's also led to where we are today. And we have to figure out the way forward to make sure that we can remove the kind of burdensome regulations and costs that are passed along to homeowners and renters. And I think there's an increasing desire to do that, again, building on what Montana did and Washington State, and Utah has taken a number of these measures. It's better to do it before there's more pain. And, hopefully by leaning into it, Colorado can get it done a few years before it otherwise would do it.
All right, so let's move on to talk about property taxes, obviously another housing-related initiative that was talked about a lot. You and I have talked about property taxes, I think, for years since the Gallagher Amendment was repealed in 2020 by voters. Why did it take so long to get this bill ready? It was dropped in the last week of session. And can you address, the criticism from counties and special districts, and even some Republicans who say that they weren't involved in the drafting of the policy?
Well, I think the right time to have done it would have been concurrent with repealing Gallagher. It was a mistake to leave. It was correct to repeal Gallagher. I supported that. It made our state less competitive for business. It had a one statewide formula for everybody. But it should have been replaced concurrently. Okay, didn't happen. So how do we replace it? It's my understanding, Jesse, that a lot of the math relied on knowing what the assessments were, and just simply put, those weren't mailed out, and we couldn't, policymakers who had to write policy and math couldn't do that before those were sent out. So, I mean, you can't really, what's important in anything fiscal is math, and you can't do math without the input numbers. So I think that's why it took so long.
I mean, certainly the assessment rates came out about a week before the bill. It was a very complex piece of legislation. So those talks must have been happening throughout the legislative term. Right?
Well, I think the main talks, Jesse, were really more, not that everybody knew we needed to do property tax relief. I think it was more, do we do it for a short period, or do we try to do it for a longer period to replace Gallagher? And a lot of good arguments on both sides. I mean, you could say, let's just do it for, a year or two and then figure it out. But I think, frankly, the people of the state want a replacement for Gallagher. They want a way that they can prevent increases in their property taxes. The truth in taxation cap under this measure does that in a very compelling way. And it also helps, I've mentioned this in some of the communications, restore some of the injustices of Gallagher. What does that mean? The shifting of the tax burden to our small businesses, making our state less competitive. We are one of the lowest tax states for homeowners. That's wonderful. 49th out of 50. Let's keep it that way. I think truth in taxation will. But we're like 24th highest on commercial property tax. I'm hoping that with the 11% decrease in that rate, we'll be significantly lower on the business front for taxes, and therefore more competitive as a state going forward.
And I'm hoping you can address too just that criticism from counties and special districts and Republicans that they felt like they were left out of the conversation. Was that intentional, or why weren't they brought into this complex discussion?
Well, everybody can't be part of every conversation. I know that many folks were consulted and listened to in this process. Ultimately, it was the legislature who had to craft sort of the right compromise, and I'm confident that Speaker McCluskey, Senator Fenberg, got a lot of input before finalizing that.
Just one more question on property taxes before we move on. There was some reporting this evening from Complete Colorado, which I know is a conservative news outlet, that there was a mistake in the bill about the name of the ballot measure, and I don't know if you've heard about this or aware of it or what's being done, but they were saying that it should have been Prop II instead of Prop HH, which is not a, it might be confusing to voters who are reading the stories, but I'm not sure if you're aware of this.
I have not been following that. The legislature referred another measure, again, I don't know the letters either, that relates to preschool. The nicotine and vaping tax took in more than the initial ask of voters. So there will also be a lettered ask. Again, I don't know the letters and I don't know which one is which, but there will be an ask around keeping the extra revenue for preschool that also went forward. So I have not seen, I don't know what either of them are called at this point, but you could probably look that up.
Okay. So moving on, kind of tied to the property tax debate, obviously, was this talk of Tabor refunds and how they're going to be distributed for the current fiscal year. These refunds will arrive in folks' mailboxes in April. And I wonder, you know, why it took so long to have this conversation around Tabor refunds. We've known that they were going to happen. And ultimately, we decided to do this flat rate mechanism that you guys chose to pursue last year. Obviously, this is tied to Proposition HH, but I wonder why it was waited, you know, that there were discussions that didn't happen until the last 3 days of the session. Lawmakers have said that part of the reason was in negotiations with your office, things didn't pan out until that final term. But what was the delay on this and why tied?
Well, I think the two discussions are related. I think the Tabor surplus, just as the last round of property tax relief, part of the Tabor surplus was used to backfill local districts for property tax relief last session. We have $200 million in the budget I signed that is for property tax relief. I think it was always anticipated that anything additional for property tax relief is our surplus dollars that would be used for property tax relief. So the two kind of need to be discussed together. Obviously, the voters will consider them together. They are fiscal matters that are kind of intricately related by the fact that the Tabor surplus goes down when you reduce property taxes.
I remember before the session, you had said that you really preferred that money be used for an income tax rate reduction. Was that something that you asked the legislature that didn't happen?
Many times, and I will many times more. And I believe that we should not have a Tabor surplus because we should cut taxes. And that means income taxes, where I've not met a good reception by the Democrats in the legislature, but it also means property taxes, where I met a better reception from the Democrats in the legislature. So rather than have the government take this money and redistribute it, we should just reduce taxes so that we don't have a Tabor surplus and let that money stay and grow in the private sector where people need it and where they've earned it.
Would that mean if say the legislature, I know there was consideration about a bill making the Tabor refunds flat in perpetuity, if something like that were to land on your desk, would you reject it? I mean, I wonder.
The key to any, you know, I've been very clear about this from day one, and obviously I ran on reducing the income tax. In my mind, the key to any more progressive Tabor refund mechanism is cutting the income tax. And so we've got to do that. The voters have done it twice. I've supported that. And the voters will do it again if the legislature doesn't find a way to temporarily do it. And that's the difference. The legislature, what I advocate, means we do it when we have a surplus. We're not like ratcheting down or locking in a lower revenue. It's only when the money's there. But the voters, and again, I support this because it was the only option we had since the legislature wouldn't act. We permanently reduced it twice. I'm very proud. One of the things I'm most proud of in my governorship is when I came in, the income tax was 4.63%, and now it's 4.4%. Again, we're for any and all additional reductions in the income tax, and we prefer them to be temporary and relate to the surplus. And we'll continue to advocate that policy with the legislature.
And just to give credit where it's due, the rate reduction was because of ballot measures that were pursued by some conservative political nonprofits. And I know you have supported a few of those vocally as they were going through, and there may be another one on the 24 ballot. We will keep track of that as it goes on. So in the time that's left, I want to tackle a few more questions. I want to talk about water. It was something that, you know, you've discussed, lawmakers at the Capitol discussed, and then ultimately, you know, it became a task force bill. I wonder if you're disappointed in that, and if you could talk about, you know, why some of these other options were pursued. Colorado Politics talked about, you know, buying water rights in the Western Slope. There was talk of a use it or lose it end of that program. Why didn't that happen? Why did we?
Well, there's a lot happening on water, and I think you'll hear from Senator Roberts in a moment on some of those. But one of the more urgent items that we needed to do is make sure that our water basins and special districts had the ability to maximize pulling down really unprecedented level of federal funds under Inflation Reduction Act, Bipartisan Infrastructure Act. These are jurisdictions that frequently cannot, because of the way they're set up, put together matching funds on their own. So we made it a priority through the budget process to make sure that our water basins and special districts are able to have the funds they need to match for federal grants that can really have a transformative impact on water in Colorado. Many of them aligned with our state water plan, some of them in parallel to our state water plan. But I'm very excited about that work, and we'll continue to move forward with water conservation, as well as making sure that we invest in the water projects we need to meet Colorado's future needs.
All right. And in the minute we have left, I kind of want to look forward a little bit. One of the things that's happening this week is the end of Title 42, which is the rule invoked by the Trump administration during the pandemic to limit migration. It's going to be, again, roll back on Thursday. And I know there's been a lot of migrants coming through Colorado. I wonder, you know, what your administration is doing and working with Denver in order to prepare for that. Is there enough money to respond to this crisis? And how are you going to handle things differently than the first time around where, you know, there was some criticism from the mayors in Chicago and New York for sending these folks along to those cities?
Yeah. So if to the extent that there are, you know, cities that are helping with this humanitarian crisis in Colorado, and I think to my knowledge right now, that's only Denver. The state is happy to help how we can, and we are supportive of Denver. And what does that mean? It means we're happy to help with logistics. We're happy to, you know, help with the support that they need us to do. There's some financial. We've extended some of our emergency funds to them in the past. And if there's a need again, we'll look at that again. Some of those are reimbursed by the federal government. Some are not. So again, we're very supportive of whatever direction, you know, different cities in Colorado choose to take. But for cities that take this on, we're happy to be there helping them. Specifically, we've called on Department of Homeland Security, the Biden administration, really three things. Obviously, one is border security. That should be one, two, and three. Border security, border security, border security. They need to get secure the border. Number two is funds. If they want interior states like Colorado to play this role in absorbing refugees, we can do it, but it should be a federal or shared responsibility to give us the resources to do that. And then third, we need temporary protected status or work authorization for Venezuelan and Nicaraguan immigrants. There's a date where they are qualified, but if they came after that date, they don't. The refugee process takes 150 to 200 days. We believe that people should have the value of individual responsibility and contribute day one, and many of them want to work day one. So how do we sort of turn a liability into an asset? And we've called on Secretary Mayorkas, the Biden administration, to do another round of TPS, temporary protected status, which pending the refugee claim, provides workplace authorization within a week or two, and that would make a big difference as well.
Thank you again for joining us. We always appreciate hearing from you on these events, Governor.
You can read more at coloradosun.com. Finally, here are a few stories that you should know about today. Lauren Boebert has filed for divorce from her husband after nearly 20 years of marriage. The U.S. representative from Colorado's 3rd Congressional District made the announcement Tuesday. The 46-page divorce petition claims their marriage is irretrievably broken. The couple has 4 children together. According to the congressman's divorce filing, Boebert requested that a judge give her potential decision-making power and child support. In court documents, a process server said when he tried to serve Jason Boebert with the divorce documents in late April, he was extremely angry, began shouting profanities, and would not take the papers. The Wildlife Sanctuary in northeastern Colorado is helping rescue and rehome hundreds of animals that have been neglected at the Puerto Rico Zoo, which closed in 2017. The 1,200-acre Colorado Sanctuary is part of a massive modern-day Noah's Ark-type effort to rescue 600 animals from the shuttered zoo. The U.S. Department of Justice enlisted the help of the Wildlife Sanctuary to lead the attempt because of its track record of saving lions, tigers, bears, and other animals. The sanctuary operates 4 sites in Colorado and Texas, encompassing 33,000 acres. The fired head of Colorado's $60 billion public pension system will receive a year's salary, more than $400,000 as severance. Ron Baker was fired May 1st by the Public Employees Retirement Association Board nearly 2 months after he went on a leave of absence. Neither the board nor PERA has said why Baker was fired, and Colorado Sun attempts over the past several months to contact him have been unsuccessful. Baker will get $412,000 because the board terminated his contract without cause. Had he been fired for cause, he wouldn't have been eligible to collect the severance. For more information on all of these stories, visit our website, coloradosun.com, and don't forget to tune in again next time. The Colorado Sun is nonpartisan and completely independent. We're always dedicated to telling the in-depth stories we need today more than ever. And the Sun is supported by readers and listeners like you. Right now, you can head to coloradosun.com and become a member, starting at $5 per month for a basic membership, and if you bump it up to $20 per month, you'll get access to our exclusive politics and outdoors newsletters. Thanks for starting your morning with us, and don't forget to tune in again tomorrow.